Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Conversations and commentary featuring scholars and visitors at the center. This is Wayne Pond. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life. Welcome to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. The Life and Political Times of Governor George Wallace of Alabama, this week on Soundings. My guest is Dan Carter, a professor of history at Emory University. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Dan Carter is writing a biography of George Wallace. According to Dan Carter, Governor Wallace is the poltergeist and the weather vane of politics in the modern American South. Dan Carter, welcome to the National Humanities Center. You got a great topic here, a life of George Wallace. A hero, a villain, boy, you can take that in lots of directions. How about this man?
Well, I was drawn to George Wallace because of the simple absence of any kind of decent biography. The last one was written 1967-68. That was the beginning of George Wallace's career, and although there have been a couple of journalistic efforts since then, I thought it was time for a kind of assessment of where he stands in American politics.
Now, you call this man the poltergeist and the weather vane of Southern American politics in the 1960s and 70s. Flesh that in for me a little bit.
Well, I think when George Wallace retired from American politics in the middle 1980s, the New York Times, which had never had much brief for him, made the case that in many ways he was probably the most important political figure in the 1960s in terms of setting the agenda in domestic affairs. Mm-hmm. And they argued that Ronald Reagan was the ultimate heir of George Wallace in terms of the kind of social issues he had aroused in the 1960s.
Tell me, Dan Carter, what as you look back on the life of the political life of George Wallace, what does he stand for? I mean, are there prominent threads that you spin out of his political life?
Well, I try to distinguish between Wallace's own personal ambitions, what it was he was trying to do, and he was trying to do what every politician's trying to do.
Get elected.
That's exactly right. But I think he, because he was such a marvelous kind of, the term has been used, mimetic orator. He was a great speaker, but he sensed what an audience wanted to hear, and he's important not so much for his own ideas, but for his ability to articulate the fears and emotions of the early 1960s and mid-1960s.
Am I being accurate or fair to George Wallace when I say that here, it seems, was a politician with whom we don't associate the spin doctors, the handlers, the pollsters, all of that, that it was just this sort of gut political relationship between one guy and several constituencies in the South? How about that?
That's certainly true, although he was himself a kind of, again, it relates to his I won't say political cunning, his political perceptions, that he was the ultimate spin doctor. I mean, time after time, he was able to put a kind of construction on his own position. But you're right, it was more than simply image, and I think that's what you're getting at, that he did speak with a kind of raw, authentic rage and anger. At least he represented it on the part of the American people.
Let's just create a bit of a footnote here very quickly, Dan Carter. When was he born? Where was he educated? Where did he spend his youth? And then we'll come back to your enterprise writing about him, this biography.
Well, actually, I think all those are relevant and more than just filling in the usual details of a biographical figure. He was born in Alabama in 1919. Really on the eve of the transformation of Southern society, in which the South, after the Civil War, Reconstruction, the poverty of the late 19th century, is gradually beginning to emerge in the American mainstream. And I think that background in Alabama politics actually turned out to be critical for George Wallace, because Alabama, although it's a Deep South state, is very atypical in some respects. as you know from having been in Alabama.
Well, how do you mean that?
Well, in the sense that it's not Mississippi. Uh-huh.
They'd say thank God for Mississippi.
Well, it has a rather strong, for example, organized labor movement. Uh-huh. It has a strong tradition of small farmer radicalism and political protest. It's no accident that out of Alabama come demagogues, as we think, but also come people like Hugo Black.
Hosea Hudson,
black radical, active in the steel industry there. Yeah. And political leaders like Lister Hill and John Sparkman. These are not the typical Southern troglodytes. and George Wallace, I think, got his political grounding in a much more complex political arena than many Southern politicians, and he learned how to play to that complex arena.
Did he ever talk about himself, define himself for a public audience? I mean, if we had him here sitting in a microphone, we said, Mr. Wallace, what is your political philosophy? Is it possible to summarize that, or is it beyond summary?
Well, I think George Wallace is probably one of the most non-introspective politicians you'd ever find. He talks out, not in. And he would have found it difficult to really do more than mouth whatever the latest speech was that he was giving. I think there was an instinctive, almost glandular kind of identification with the working class as he saw it. Although he wasn't terribly poor, he came from a relatively modest background and certainly made a kind of emotional and even conscious decision to associate himself, not even with the upper middle class, but with working class Alabamians and Americans.
When we think about George Wallace in terms of a topic like education, the image is pretty bitter, pretty negative. Was he a racist? I mean, in your biography, Dan Carter, are you going to use a word like that in describing this man's behavior when it comes to education in the South?
Well, you know, that's interesting. That's something his own son once asked one of Wallace's close friends confidentially. He said, "Do you think my father was a racist?" This is later, after Wallace had changed his racial views. And the only way I try to answer this is to suggest that the moral compass of George Wallace was ambition. And I don't think he was instinctively, certainly not in terms of his background, more racist than others of his generation, probably less. But when the political demand was that he adopt a racist position in the early 1960s, then he didn't hesitate very long.
Politics equaled the expedient.
That's right. Uh-huh. And all politicians have to face that kind of struggle between what they have to do to get elected, and there's no question about it. For example, in comparison with Jimmy Carter.
Right.
Carter was extraordinarily fortunate in coming along a few years later, because when George Wallace came along in the late 1950s and the early 1960s, there was no place for the middle of the road on race. I mean, as someone said in Texas, the only thing in the middle of the road are dead armadillos and yellow stripes. that there's no place for a moderate politician on race. And Wallace made, and I don't want to use a too high flown a comparison here, but he made a kind of Faustian bargain. Once he decided to use race to get elected in 1962, as he did, then however much he may have changed his views, he would always be saddled with that. He would always be saddled with his inaugural address, in which he segregation now, today, and forever.
Right.
Always be saddled with his stand in the schoolhouse door.
Suppose, Dan Carter, that you were writing a history of Alabama in the 20th century rather than a biography of George Wallace. Where would you place this man in the spectrum of society and politics and the history of that state? Is he absolutely crucial? Is he a great modifying force? Help me to understand his position in those terms.
Well, how long is our program run? We got about 30 minutes here. There we can. he is definitely the heir of a reform tradition, which begins in the 1920s and 30s, culminates in Big Jim Folsom, James Folsom, two-term governor in the 40s and 50s, with whom Wallace was closely associated until he broke in the late 1950s, partly for political reasons. And in terms of his own political background, he is a reformer. I mean, if you look at his political career in the legislature in the late 1940s, he saw himself as such.
Isn't that a wonderful irony? I mean, outside of the South, the social critics look at him and say, man, here is a guy who never moved into the 20th century.
No, not at all. Wallace was not, that doesn't in any way describe himself. By national standards, he would be considered quite conservative. By Alabama standards, he was, as he described himself in the 40s and 50s, a liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that does not mean that his political programs would pass the litmus test from the Americans for Democratic Action, but it's definitely a liberal by Alabama standards.
Uh-huh. Let's move him onto the national scene. Given what you've said about Wallace's role in Alabama politics, was he transformative? Was he important? How do you assess his position in presidential politics?
Well, what Wallace did was he changed the rules of the game, I think, even more than someone like Barry Goldwater, who exalted extremism in the 1964 campaign. Because what Wallace was willing to do, and in a way that ultimately, of course, has its downside, and that is he was willing to say things, however much he used coded words, that no other politicians were willing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that in later generations, later political generations, the kinds of issues of race, although they're never going to be discussed in the explicitly race-baiting language of the 1950s and 1960s, Wallace introduces a kind of rhetoric about social divisions in American society, mainly revolving around welfare, around the civil rights issue, and inserts that into the public vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
And he does that in a very angry way in the mid-1960s. And in that sense, he considered himself nothing more than the voice of the people. But uh-huh. Nevertheless, he was the one that brought that vocabulary into the mainstream and forced politicians like Richard Nixon and others to come to terms with it.
Mm-hmm. What about a term like states' rights? How do you look at Wallace and identify him, move him away from, toward a concept like that? Still very much alive, I take it.
Well, I mean, you can always be cynical, but you can really be cynical when you talk about states' rights with George Wallace. I mean, never was there, or seldom was there a politician who more cheerfully welcomed federal support, federal intervention, federal funds, than Wallace and the tradition he represented in Alabama politics.
Up to a point of
interfering with race relations. Yeah. I mean, clearly the objection was not to the federal government, but the federal government trying to enforce civil rights legislation in the South.
Mm-hmm.
So the hair on the back of my neck always rises a little bit when I hear people talking about that the real issue in the 1960s with Wallace was states' rights. That's just baloney.
Uh-huh. What about his personal life, Dan Carter? How are you going to write about this man? What kinds of stories are you going to tell? Secrets are you going to reveal? How do you figure out the difference when it comes down to the biographical enterprise between the man's life and the man's work?
Well, the two are obviously related, or I wouldn't be doing a biography. The biographical part's difficult. George Wallace was not an introspective person. He didn't write a lot. He talked to people a lot, and I've had to depend to a considerable degree upon the work of journalists who knew him in the early period and interviews. I've done about 80 hours of interviews with associates of Wallace and, mm-hmm. and used the work by other interviewers in earlier times.
Have you spoken with him?
No, his health is extremely poor at this time, and I've spoken to his son, George Jr., and other close associates, but I've not talked to Governor Wallace, and I don't think he's going to be able to ever completely tell his own story.
Does this biography that you're doing, Dan Carter, does it have his blessing? Are you have
no,
any sense
no,
of that?
No, not at all. Quite uh-huh. the contrary.
What about the very personal elements in George Wallace's life? His sexual behavior, his moral attitudes, his life, as it were, behind closed doors. It's always been, I suppose, of interest to the electorate, the way men and women in public office live personally and how that relates to their political behavior. How do you approach that very sensitive kind of thing as you write this biography?
I haven't approached it yet. I hadn't written that chapter, and I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do. Clearly, there's been a sea change in the last 10 years. We've known, historians have known, after people have safely been interred, about their own personal foibles, perhaps their sexual foibles. We know that Grover Cleveland had a mistress and had an illegitimate child. In fact, that was even known at the time, but it wasn't something that polite people discussed. Well, I don't know whether you date it pre-Gary Hart and post-Gary Hart, but clearly there's a totally different...
How about FDR?
Right. We certainly never discussed it in FDR's times, the fact that he had close emotional relationships, whatever they were. So the rules have changed. However, I really want to try to avoid voyeurism for its own sake. I'm not trying to tell a kind of Inquirer version of George Wallace's life. Where I think it may be relevant, it has to do with his relationships with his family as well as with other women in his life, and what this may tell us about the man and his ability to seek power and gain power. Mm-hmm. But to that extent, I'm interested in the story, not in trying to do a kind of expose of what went on behind closed doors.
What about inside this man's mind, Dan Carter? Is anybody going to accuse you of being a psychobiographer, whatever that means?
Well, no, I don't think so. Although I'm going to try to tell as much as I can about George Wallace's childhood, about his relationships with other individuals, with people, with the women in his life, with his family, with his friends.
You find these formative, I take it?
I think so. I think so. Although I'm always dubious about individuals, there's a kind of foreordained quality once a person's life is over. You describe what they did, then you go back and you ramble through their childhood and their adolescence, and you find all these factors that led them inevitably in this direction. Whereas, of course, they may have had a twin brother or sister who had the same formative influences and turned out to be quite different. But I am interested in that.
What about your own personal prejudices? And I mean no disrespect, and I'm not hinting at anything negative in your character, but you make subjective judgments. How do you figure out what to leave in, what to leave out in terms of the agenda that you bring to this biography of Wallace?
Well, I don't bridle at all at the suggestion that I have prejudices. I think we always do, and anyone who's not honest enough to admit that is starting out on the wrong foot to begin with. I have certain basic notions about the rightness or wrongness of George Wallace's positions. I don't like the way he treated black people in Alabama in the 1950s and 60s. I think most biographers would begin with that assumption. I do like to believe that I come at it from perhaps a little bit different perspective. I grew up in the Deep South. My family is all from the Deep South. And so that I try to balance my own sense of indignation and my disgust and distaste for certainly Wallace's racial views with my sympathy and understanding for, or at least my attempts to understand, even if I can't agree with, the kind of fears and emotions that drove white Southerners in the direction that it did. Mm. I was at a conference once in which one of the other participants kept referring to white Southerners as those people. Mm. And I finally said, well, you know, the problem is those are my people. They're not those people in the sense that I like to believe that black Southerners are my people too. I'm a Southerner. As much as I'm also an American and a scholar and an academic, and trying to sympathize with, trying to understand the points of view doesn't mean you agree with them. But I'd like to believe I bring that prejudice as well.
Mm-hmm. What about the so-called New South, Dan Carter? Do you believe in that kind of formulation? How do you fit Mr. Wallace into what appears to be something different that's going on in the southern states since, I don't know, where do we date it? The early 60s, right around the time that Wallace was elected, huh?
Well, the problem is it seems like about every 5 years another New South comes along. You know, Henry Grady talked about it in the 1880s, and every generation discovers a New South. There are New South governors and New South ideas. I think the most of the changes that have come to the region have been very gradual. The most dramatic ones, I suspect, have been in the years between World War II and the 1960s. I mean, you have not only the economic transformation of the region, but also the destruction of segregation as a legal system, which simply brings the South closer to the nation in terms of racial policies and prejudices. But the notion that there's somehow some dramatic overnight transformation, I don't buy that.
What about the life, the politics of George Wallace preparing us for Southern culture, not only into the next decade, but here we're, you know, about to approach the threshold of a new century. Is he still with us? Is he behind us? How important is he?
He's still with us, but I do see him as a figure of the past rather than a figure of the future. What George Wallace, and I may reshape this slightly as I actually do the writing, but I think I see him as a figure of closure, a figure of protest and fear at being dragged willy-nilly into the 21st century. He's a kind of last angry cry of basically white Southerners and also other Americans. I mean, that's what he did. He connected not just to Southerners, but to people outside the South who were frightened and angry over what they saw as these changes. And ultimately, I think I see him as a nostalgic figure, a figure who's trying to return America, the South, to the way that he remembers it from his childhood. All politicians, to some degree, are nostalgic, but I think Wallace much more than others.
Do you connect him with anybody on the political scene here in the early 1990s? People like, Lyndon LaRouche is in prison recording this conversation.
No.
I mean, do you make that jump?
He certainly used the radical right. And in the late in the 1990 elections, for example, the strong showing of someone like David Duke would seem to suggest that the Wallace spirit is still alive. But that's a wonderful thing about writing a biography of him. He's such a useful kind of explanatory figure for just about any degree or any upsurge in the voter discontent, because that's what he reflected. And so he becomes almost a chameleon-like character who can represent any level of discontent, any aspect of discontent. But no, I don't think there's anyone quite like Wallace. Because despite the success of David Duke, which I believe is closely related to the circumstances in Louisiana, I don't think the circumstances in the 1990s are those of the 1960s and 70s, which is where Wallace really, really had his heyday.
Now, again, as we record this conversation, Dan Carter, you said that Governor Wallace's health is not good. Let's suppose that, be whimsical for a moment, that we had him here at a third microphone. Are there particular issues that you would ask him about, questions that you would put to him about his policies, his life, that would guide you as you write this biography?
Oh, I'm sure that I would want to go over many of the same questions that other people have asked him. Someone in public life as long as George Wallace was, there are not many questions that he wasn't asked, at least those that were on the table in the 1960s and 1970s. I suspect I'd like to know more about his childhood, about what it was like growing up. The newspaper people are no criticism intended, but very, very presentist, and I was intrigued by a friend of his who, when I was talking about Wallace's reading habits, not that you can divine something, politicians don't read very much, but I noticed that he always referred when someone would ask him what he read in an attempt to show how ignorant and backward he was. As a kind of rote reflex, he'd say, well, I've read my favorite is Lee's Lieutenants. Well, he must have worn that thing out just talking about it, and I don't know whether he'd read it or not. But this friend who knew him quite well said, well, that wasn't really his favorite book. His favorite book was Backtracking in Barber County, a superb, it really is a very good county history, written in 1941. Uh-huh. And she pointed out that he had had a leather-bound copy of that book. And he read it, knew it from beginning to end, and it's a fascinating book, which is very much related not only to Barber County, but the whole process by which the land was tamed, which Indians were driven out. It has the conventional view of Reconstruction, and I'd love to sit down and talk with him about his perceptions. I know, for example, that as a child, the last of the Confederate veterans were still alive in the 1920s and 1930s.
Yeah, the last of them died in 1959.
That's right. Well, so. in as late as 1915, there were still over 200 surviving Confederate veterans in Barbour County. Yeah, well, that's the time of his birth, but a good number of those were still alive as he grew up in Clio and Clayton and in Barbour County. And those are the kinds of things I'd like to ask him, not the issues dealing with his presidential campaigns, which have been pretty well covered.
Uh-huh. What difference do you think that the biography that you're writing is going to make to the Southern agenda, to Southern scholarship?
Well, actually, I hope historians will read the book, but I confess it's not written for historians. All of us bemoan the loss of historical literacy. Not just historians, but other people who read worry about the fact that Americans seem to have no sense of roots, no sense of the past. And I think in part that's due to a lot of things, television and so on. In part it's due to the fact that historians have simply given up. They've stopped writing for a general audience and assume that their first and primary function is to write for each other.
So you're telling a story.
I'm telling a story, but I hope it's a story that has meaning for more than just my profession, that it has meaning for literate Americans who were interested about in learning something about where we came from. It's reflected in a talk I gave a couple of years ago. It was at Fordham University, and it could have been anywhere, and I had about 40 young people, about 19 or 20 in a class there, and I began talking about George Wallace. And there were these blank looks on their face. And finally I stopped and I said, how many of you know who George Wallace is? About four did.
Goodness.
Well, it's not that I think they ought to know about George Wallace, but I think they ought to know something about what the 1960s and 70s and earlier, what it was about. So it's self-serving. I want to write a book that a lot of people will read. For obvious financial reasons, but I also would like to be part of what I see as a kind of resurgence of historical writing, which is written for a general audience. I mean, there really has been in the last 8 or 10 years, much of it, unfortunately or fortunately, led by journalists, and I think historians have something to say, too.
Dan Carter teaches at Emory University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During a fellowship year at the center, Dan Carter is working on a political biography of Governor George Wallace of Alabama. Soundings on the Life and Times of George Wallace is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 539. That's program number 539. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, the first installment in a series of discussions for Black History Month 1991. Over the next 4 weeks, my guests will include the novelist Toni Morrison, the historian John Hope Franklin, the biographer Arnold Rampersad, the cultural critic Henry Louis Gates, Jr., and the literary historian Lucinda MacHeathen. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. The Life and Times of Governor George Wallace of Alabama. This week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for a conversation with Dan Carter of Emory University. Dan Carter will discuss his biography of Governor George Wallace of Alabama, whom he calls the poltergeist and weather vane of politics in the modern American South. The Life and Political Times of George Wallace. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.